And I understand you were court-appointed as well, were you not?
Yes,
apparently at trial and appeal.
Yes,
okay, well, we appreciate your taking the assignment and work for your client. Next case be United States versus Clifford Lawson. Mr. Truitt.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Clifford Lawson contends that the district court did not impose a sentence that was sufficient but not greater than necessary to comply with the factors of sentencing. In fact, district court relied in its sentencing memorandum on the presumption of reasonableness and specifically found in its 35 or purported 3553 analysis that the guidelines were the best indicators of the offense seriousness, the need to promote respect for law, the need for just punishment, and the avoidance of unwarranted disparity. And certainly the court, the district court, implicitly relied on the guidelines as the best indicator of deterrence and the need to protect the public from future crimes of the defendant. We believe that the procedure utilized by Chief Judge Miller constitutes procedural unreasonableness, and that the court did not comply with the explicit commands of 18 United States Code Section 3553A. The first command that is not mentioned in the court's sentencing memorandum, and unfortunately not mentioned in many of the decisions of this court, is the overriding command of Congress to sentencing courts is that they should impose a sentence sufficient but not greater than necessary to satisfy the purposes of sentencing. 3553A then goes on to set out six purposes of sentencing, and then lists seven factors which the court should look to. Now, the defendant believes that the statement of Judge Posner, writing on behalf of the majority in United States versus Demery, is the correct approach for the district courts to apply. It can be argued that Judge Posner's comments are dicta, since that case specifically related to whether the ex post facto clause should still apply to sentencing under the advisory guideline. But it became very relevant to the outcome of the case when the appellants were saying, but Judge, under the presumption of reasonableness, and the way the court has viewed and the burdens placed on the defendant, that makes the sentencing guidelines ipso facto mandatory. And therefore, the ex post facto clause is even more vital than it was before. And Judge Posner said, no.
Let's stay with this case for a minute. The problem is that you or the defense urged a sentence of no prison time at all here, which sounds to me pretty unreasonable, I thought. And the judge imposed a sentence at the bottom of the advisory guideline range, and you have no problem with how that range was calculated. And the arguments against it, he's 52 years old, so arguing like he's way over the hill and can't involve himself in any more criminal activity and things like that. I just didn't see any merit to any of those contentions. Why a sentence below a properly calculated guideline range would be viewed as unreasonable, presumption or no presumption of reasonableness?
Well, I respectfully disagree, Your Honor, statistically. And I understand, you know, there's lies and damn lies and statistics. But statistically, as found by the Sentencing Commission, people, you know, past the age of 50 are less likely to commit crimes. As a general rule, that's correct. Is it a correct rule in this instance? I guess that's debatable. You certainly feel that it's not a correct rule.
The older I get, the younger 52 sounds.
Secondly, I think the command is a sentence of probation in this case unreasonable. You obviously think that it is, and certainly it's a long way from the sentence mandated by the guideline calculation. But one of the things that 3553, and one of the things that I think Booker did was change the focus. The guidelines focus on crime. They focus on the appropriate punishment for a particular crime. They do not focus on the individual and an appropriate sentence for the individual. In fact, the guidelines specifically prohibit the court, unless that finds extraordinary circumstances, for considering some of the human factors set forth in Chapter 5 of the guidelines. So you have someone who committed a crime 13 years ago, and that was his only crime. Someone who's gone to work every day, who's been married for a significant period of time, who's been a productive member of society.
But there's evidence that he was possessing guns during a period of time, even though he wasn't caught with them. And the weapon here is a sawed-off shotgun, which is pretty scary to begin with.
That certainly is troubling, Your Honor. But possession of a firearm by a convicted felon is not necessarily a blanket offense. There was evidence presented that two of the guns, at least, were passed on, or one of the guns was passed on from his father, one that he had for years, and the .22 he'd purchased as a little side job at work shooting rats. His wife said that she never even saw them handle them. He tried to get rid of them. Not very effectively, I admit, but his mother had them for a while, and that's not the police report indicates that she told the police, but I gave them back to him, and he'd give them back to me. The firearm in Clifford's hands is far less dangerous, is a much different situation than a firearm in a multiple convicted drug offender or a bank robber or somebody who has a history of violent acts against others. I understand that Clifford's crime was considered a crime of violence, but not all crimes of violence are committed, are equal. Some of them are certainly much more violent than others. And so if you look at the nature of the possession, it was never used. It was never out of the house other than to his mother's house. He didn't use them. He didn't even hold them. I think the court can legitimately consider that under the nature and circumstances of the offense. And I think the court has to consider that under the nature and circumstances of the offense. And I think the court has to consider each and every factor, and I don't think the court can merely rely on saying the guidelines are the best indicator. I don't think that complies with the mandate of the Supreme Court. And I don't think that applies with the mandate of Congress when it created 18 United States Code Section 3553. There is a number of, yes, he had guns. Yes, one of them was a sawed-off gun. And how that came into existence was very murky, and I understand troubling to the court and in many ways troubling to myself. But
he also threatened to kill the police.
There was an allegation.
There's some inconvenient little things
that he did, and it was take down the police. Even from the 911 received a call, and this is one of the things that I think the court and Congress has to look at. is, you know, the quantum of evidence. There was a 911 call who said, you know, Clifford called and said, you know, if my guns aren't back by 7 o'clock, somebody's going to pay even if I have to take down the police. That doesn't mean kill the police. That person who made that statement never appeared in court, never was under oath, never was cross-examination. An allegation suddenly becomes unrefutable truth, and that's unfair. And that was part of the judge's order. He referred to that. There was no evidence to support that. Even the officer who heard it didn't even come in and testify. I mean, it was an assertion, a proper assertion, made by Mr. Barrett at the detention hearing. At the issue of detention, and suddenly this thing has had a life of its own, and he threatened to kill all the Mishawaka police. That's simply not true, and it was I think inappropriate under the circumstances to rely on an assertion that was never presented into evidence, never even presented to show that it had an indicia of reliability, which is required before the court can consider it in a sentencing hearing. My time is up. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Barrett.
May it please the court. My understanding of Mr. Lawson's argument through Mr. Truitt is more that he's challenging this court's and the Supreme Court's Booker jurisprudence. He's challenging that law more than he's challenging the application of that law to these facts. The argument that the district court should not have started out giving the guidelines range a presumption of reasonableness flies in the face of this court's post-Booker jurisprudence. The argument that he should not have considered the guideline range to the extent that he did flies in the face of this court's post-Booker jurisprudence. The court here did everything that a post-Booker sentencing court is required to do. It calculated the guidelines range, a calculation that was not challenged, and then it analyzed all of the Section 3553A factors in going into some depth in the analysis, focusing particularly on the history and characteristics of this defendant and the circumstances of the crime. Now, as to this court's standard of review, you know, was this a reasonable sentence? The court here gave some breaks, even under the guidelines, to Mr. Lawson. The court sentenced him at the low end of the guidelines range, not at the high end. The court granted a two-level reduction for acceptance of responsibility, even though Mr. Lawson sent two letters to the court, which could be construed, as the court acknowledged, and in some sense as not accepting responsibility. But the court resolved that in the defendant's favor. So Mr. Lawson is challenging a sentence which is already much lower than he could have received under a presumptively reasonable guideline sentence. And then just looking at the circumstances of the offense, I know that the court's aware of what's in the brief and what Mr. Truitt has just said, but Mr. Lawson was convicted of a crime of violence, child molesting. He possessed guns on and off for the course of 13 years. Those were four guns, including a sawed-off shotgun. He possessed ammunition in close proximity to those guns. He made suicidal threats. And then when the guns were taken, he made threats to the police and to the people who had reported him, his suicidal threats to the police. And in addition, not one but two courts had ordered him detained based on this offense, based on the circumstances of the offense. The magistrate judge ordered him detained, and upon review, the district court upheld that order of detention. So this is a defendant who comes before the court looking at a crime, felon in possession, which actually did pose some danger. And the court could have gone farther. The court said he poses a modest threat of danger as opposed to a minimal threat. When looking at the threats that Mr. Lawson made to the police and to the people who reported him, to the police, he could have gone beyond modest. He could have said this man posed a very real threat. He had four guns and ammunition. So as to whether it is a reasonable or unreasonable sentence, when you look at the entirety of the circumstances of the offense, as the sentencing court was required to do, it becomes apparent that, in fact, this was a reasonable sentence at the low end of the guidelines range after the court had considered all the circumstances of the offense, all of the letters that Mr. Lawson mailed to the court, and all the arguments of counsel. If the court has no questions, I think that concludes my argument.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Your time has expired. I think you're completed. Yeah. So this case will be taken under advisement.